Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. If you go back as far as I do, then you remember that the old Superman comics of the 1960s introduced a fictional planet called Bizarro World, where everything is the opposite of Earth. Well, thanks to the radical left transformation of our culture and their normalization of all kinds of insane beliefs and behavior, we're all living in Bizarro World now, where men can be women, ugliness is the new beauty standard, and freedom of speech is considered a fascist threat. Let's talk about that last one. The left, which used to at least claim to be the defenders of free speech in this country, has exposed its true totalitarian side in recent years in fervently shutting down speech that they don't like by weaponizing the term hate speech and claiming that words are violence. They created cancel culture to ostracize and punish people who dare to dissent from progressive orthodoxy. They created safe spaces on college campuses where people can protect themselves from what they consider harmful speech. Lately, they've taken their intolerance to a whole new level, murdering political opponents like Charlie Kirk, whose whole activism was centered on going to college campuses and peacefully debating people. The left considered this to be such a heinous and traumatizing threat that he had to be executed for it. It should be extremely concerning to all Americans that this First Amendment right, a degree of freedom of speech that no other nation in the world is blessed with, is now being targeted for narrower restrictions and possibly even eradication by a whole generation or two of young people indoctrinated to see it as a tool of Nazis and fascists. The irony there that they want to control your speech because it's an inconvenient obstacle to their lust for one-party power seems to have escaped them entirely. Or more likely, they're aware of the hypocrisy and just don't care, because power is all that matters to them. My guest today on The Right Take is the author of a brand new book on free speech, which views it through the lens of clinical psychology to explain why free speech matters, how you can wield it with wisdom and discernment, and without fear, even in a left-dominated culture that is hostile to expressing opinions that challenge or oppose that culture. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a clinical psychologist and USA Today bestselling author, whom I had on this podcast previously to talk about her book Nervous Energy, Harness the Power of Your Anxiety. She's a frequent speaker at universities, at nonprofits, and law firms, and elsewhere, and she's all over the media, including Fox News, ABC Nightline, and other places. She's a brand new book out called Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. Dr. Chloe Carmichael, welcome back to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's so great to be with you again.
Great to have you. Your new book couldn't be more timely, could it?
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I wanted to write this book even a few years ago, but I had trouble finding a publisher for whatever reason. I guess the publishing industry leans so far left, but yes. Anyway, I'm glad it's out now.
Yeah, well, free speech has become a vital topic now. It's become a literal battleground across America, and it's not just a cancel culture anymore, although that was bad enough. Now it can literally be a matter of life and death. People are very worried today, and have been for quite a few years, about what they can say in public or on social media that won't get them fired or worse. The recent assassination of Charlie Kirk, of course, brings this to mind, a guy whose activism was based largely on traveling to college campuses and engaging people in open debate. That just shows to what extent some people will go to shut down speech with which they disagree. Now, Charlie Kirk was obviously a conservative, but are concerns about freedom of speech just a right-wing thing?
You know, that's a good question. It does seem to be right now coded as a right-wing issue, yeah. But really, I think free speech should be something we all care about. You know, in the 80s and 90s, it was actually more the liberals that were you know, fighting against censorship in rap music, and it was the right that wanted to put, you know, explicit lyrics warnings and things. So the issue has flip-flopped a bit over the years. And then I guess we could have some interesting discussions about if globalized the Intifada, for example. Yeah. You know, like that would be an issue where the left is trying to push that as a free speech issue. But yeah, I think in general, in fact, as well, I can get into some statistics. People on the left do tend to be what I call a little bit more dialogue intolerant these days.
Yeah. Well, your book does frame free speech not as a purely political issue, though, but also as a psychological and emotional issue. Now, this is kind of a big question, but what are the emotional and psychological and social consequences of living in a cancel culture culture?
Yeah, I mean, the consequences are big if we stifle ourselves. And I say this from personal experience. I didn't really understand myself, even as a psychologist, the mental health costs of holding back just to kind of go along to get along. But yeah. When we stifle ourselves, we're doing what psychologists call repression and suppression. And that can set the stage for denial, where we start to kind of shut down mentally parts of ourselves that feel, you know, taboo. And so that can really dampen actually our cognitive process, because our problem-solving abilities or even our ability to be rational and objective about our thought process hinges in part on being able to be open and use the gift of language to, you know, dialogue and examine and analyze our thought process. And then on an emotional level, we use language to emotionally regulate ourselves. So that's why, you know, it's like a pressure cooker when somebody doesn't talk and they're holding everything in, and then they just blurt it all out and they say, well, I'm so glad I got that off my chest, right? These are just layman's terms, but there's also plenty of studies that show that, you know, the amygdala part of the brain calms down when we label our emotions, our cortisol levels drop, all that stuff. And then lastly, so we've got the cognitive and emotional piece of free speech. And then these also are in the social benefits. So social support is a key part of mental health. And when we're not being real with people, or they're not being real with us, of course that hurts our social support and therefore our mental health.
And that sort of ties into what you call the loneliness epidemic that has struck Americans. How does that tie in with freedom of speech?
Yeah. So, you know, when we are not being authentic with people because we're afraid of being canceled, you know, they don't really know us, or we don't really know them. Or, you know, maybe I'm secretly resenting my neighbor because I'm saying, oh, well, if I told her what I really think, then, you know, she'd, you know, cancel me because she's, you know, so uptight about her views. And then I'm resenting somebody for something that they haven't even done yet, because I haven't even told her what I really think, right?
Yeah.
So it's ironic that I feel like it's primarily the left that wants to tamp down on free speech because of, quote, hate speech and bullying. But ironically, it's really through open dialogue that we resolve problems. And it's by stifling dialogue that we're actually going to be more prone to having problems with hate speech, bullying, and violence.
One of the statistics that you mention is that a whopping 84% of Americans view self-censorship and cancel culture as serious problems. I wonder if it's actually more than that, but some people are reluctant to say so.
How ironic.
Yes. But that's, you know, that's pretty close to 100%. So this is obviously a major social and cultural issue. One of the things I liked about your book, we've heard a lot in recent years as this free speech issue has heated up, this claim that words are violence. But I was gratified to see that in your book you assert that words are not violence. Why is this notion so pervasive in today's cultural conversations, and how do you help your readers dismantle that notion?
Yeah, words are not violence. In fact, frankly, I wanted to call the book that, but for whatever reason, that didn't go over so well. But words are not violence is a phrase that is used by people. Words are violence is a phrase that is used by people to shut down other people's speech. Right? They say words are violence, so therefore you can't say that. And ironically, they're often, you know, those are the people who are most prone to violence. And statistics show that people who are, you know, the most dialogue intolerant are actually also the most likely to be violent. And it's so insidious because they'll say words are violence, you know, as if like, well, I'm the kind person here. I'm stopping the violence. I'm stopping, you know, your words. Whereas ironically, it's one of the least kind, it's one of the most bullying things that you can do to shut somebody up. And moreover, as a clinical psychologist, I believe it's actually psychotic, okay? Because psychotic means broken from reality. And when we confuse words with violence, that is psychotic. Like I, as a psychologist, if somebody tells me in private session that he's going to say something super mean to his wife, I'm legally prohibited from calling the authorities or telling anybody about that. But if he tells me that he's going to, you know, beat the hell out of his wife, I'm legally required to alert the authorities or her. So there's an obvious objective difference. We can't interfere with reality and expect it's not going to interfere with people's mental health.
Yes, it's funny. The same people who have redefined words as violence have also redefined violence as self-defense. So much of this seems to involve universities. Why are they so often at the center of free speech controversies and clashes?
Well, okay, because first of all, they have skewed extremely far to the left. So you want to take a guess, for example, what the left-right skew is, like, say, Democrat to Republican ratio is at schools in the Northeast, for example. Can you guess?
I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say 70-30.
You're close. Yeah, it's 28-1. So it's actually even beyond that. You know, it's pretty shocking,
wow.
Right? And, you know, that's New England. But there's just across the whole country, it's pretty close to that. It's say like 20-1, for example, in psychology departments or journalist departments in general. And that means that since maybe your average faculty department only has 10 or 12 faculty members, it's going to be, there's plenty of departments where you have just a 100% of the faculty at that department, you know, lean left. So basically they have this total echo chamber. There's nobody putting a check on their ideas. They're only taking in new faculty that think like they do, because we know this because the skew has gotten worse over time. They're only admitting students who think like they do, or who at least pretend to think like they do. They're oftentimes getting funded, you know, by not-profits and other places that have a political agenda. So, you know, as you said, it's a perfect storm. And these universities are pumping out research that is wildly biased, right? These are the same places that are pumping out so-called research that tells us that it's perfectly good and healthy to chop off the healthy body parts of a minor, right? And we're supposed to believe that that there's no bias here.
And then it doesn't end at graduation, though, does it? Because university culture ultimately becomes workplace culture.
Oh, yeah. I mean, exactly. And so these students are trained there, and they come into their intellectual abilities thinking that smart people ostracize, belittle, and shut down conservative ideas. And this is why, for example, you know, many places are saying that they don't want to hire Ivy League graduates anymore. I say this as an Ivy grad myself, so no disrespect, but I totally get it. So these students, they come out really not only lacking in, you know, serious knowledge and education and critical thinking abilities, but they come out with a great degree of bias that doesn't actually map on to what at least half of the country really thinks.
I think it's great that you do address in the book the objections to free speech, because it's common now for many people to view free speech as a tool that empowers fascists. It's kind of bizarre to me that the young people today view this important, vital right that only Americans have as a threat of some kind, that we need safe spaces to protect us from it. How should people look at the issue of free speech versus, say, misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech?
Yeah, I'm so glad you're asking that. So, I mean, I wrote the book partly as a way to give everyday people a way to answer back when people do try to shut down their free speech with these common but very misguided objections. Like, you know, for example, as you said, well, what about misinformation? We have to tamp down on free speech because of misinformation. You know, when actually Galileo was jailed for the rest of his life for saying that the Earth orbits the sun, or, you know, during COVID, you'd be yanked off the internet for saying that maybe we shouldn't be masking toddlers or, you know, grown people all day, or even, you know, pulled off of X for saying that a man cannot become a woman. And experts are wrong all the time, right? My own profession, we used to lobotomize people. There's footage of physicians testifying to Congress that cigarettes are fine for pregnant women as long as they use a filter, right? So, I mean, it would be an unreasonable expectation to put upon experts that they should never be wrong. So therefore, we should be able to question and discuss even what the experts say. I'm so glad you're asking about that, because I think that's an important one.
I did find your chapters on the cognitive aspects of language and speech to be really interesting, because I'm kind of a nerd. What are a couple of the cognitive benefits of language?
Yeah, so language, it's something that we don't even think about. It's like breathing. It's a complex activity that we don't think about at all because, you know, we do it almost unconsciously. But what we do when we speak is we take kind of an amorphous, maybe hectic, chaotic interior life, and we put it into a rational, objective system called language that is actually understandable and relatable to other people. So it forces us to start becoming specific about, you know, the words that we use and the ideas that we communicate. Language allows us to rapidly exchange information and knowledge with other people and to become very objective about our own ideas. For example, we've all had the experience of saying something aloud and then as we say it, saying, oh, you know what, as I say this, I guess it doesn't actually make sense, right? Like now that I hear myself say it. So language allows us to develop good ideas and to discard bad ideas as well. It gives us, you know, a healthy sense of distance between ourselves and our ideas. And, you know, when we have definitions, it allows us to test ideas with rhetoric and logic and hypotheses. It's almost impossible to overstate the cognitive benefits of language. When we have people that have a paucity of language, they don't have enough language, it's been demonstrated that that actually puts a limit on their cognitive activity, and that when we can enrich someone's vocabulary, we actually enrich and strengthen their IQ and their overall thinking and reasoning abilities, because language allows us to do that. Just think about, say, if-then statements. Without language, it's very difficult to think in that type of complex linear process.
And alongside that chapter, you've got a similar one called The Emotional Gifts of Language. Can you talk about a couple of those?
Yeah. So when we label our emotions, what happens right then and there is our amygdala begins to calm down. The amygdala is the part of the brain that gets active when we have fear. And it can become active even when it's not rational to be so. For example, it's rational for my amygdala to get active if I see a rattlesnake. It's not rational if I, you know, somebody says an idea that I don't like, right? But yet, nevertheless, the unconscious, the mind doesn't have to be rational. So the amygdala can just go off. The beauty of language is that it introduces rationality. So when I start saying, you know what, when you talk about affirmative action, I just get panicked. Then as I hear myself saying that, the amygdala begins to calm down because I start putting words on it, and it just simply having a system makes the brain start to feel like there's something that's more in control here. And the fact that we have language at all and we can talk, the brain begins to calm down. Our cortisol levels actually start to drop when we can, you know, discuss emotions and again, be analytical about them. So if you and I were meeting for dinner and you were 5 minutes late and I became furious, and then I said, well, you know what, you were 5 minutes late and I'm totally furious, as I even heard myself saying it, the emotion I would start to realize didn't match the event. And all of that happens because I can compare and contrast through language. People just don't realize it because we it's like breathing. We do it without thinking.
There's so much in this book that's really useful to people. You have a chapter on effective tools for speaking up. Could you talk about a couple of those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking up is so important. You know, when you think about it, when we put, say, a prisoner in solitary confinement, that's one of the worst things that we can do to them, right, is to cut them off from other people. And so many of us cut ourselves off, you know, just by choosing to not speak up in the first place. So if people are in a situation where they want to speak up, it can be super helpful to even just get an ally, whether it be the Thanksgiving dinner table or a university classroom. If you're thinking of speaking up and you're scared, tell a friend, I'm thinking of speaking up and I'm wondering, you know, if you could just back me up a little bit. Or, you know, sometimes it's important to ask yourself, am I afraid of speaking up because I'm concerned about an actual consequence? Like, am I concerned that this professor is going to retaliate against me? Or am I concerned about, you know, losing the relationship here? Like, what is the concern? And then, you know, then you can start problem solving and thinking backwards about how to protect yourself, you know, from whatever the feared consequence is, or of even just how to face that potential consequence. Because what good is a relationship, really, if we can't even be ourselves in that relationship?
Yeah. And in addition to that chapter, you've got one, and I wasn't expecting this. I mean, you had a chapter on speaking up, but you also have a chapter on tools for self-restraint. Now, I think when it comes to talking about free speech, most people think in terms of unrestrained expression, not self-restraint. Tell us that about that aspect.
Yeah, it is so important. So just like, you know, now there are more tools in the book for speaking up than there are for self-restraint, but there are some for self-restraint as well. Because if we want people to listen to us and give us the floor, we have to be willing to, you know, do the same. So I encourage people that if somebody's, you know, talking and talking and saying stuff that you just think makes no sense, even just something as simple as challenging yourself to see how many minutes you can listen before you feel the need to interrupt, or challenge yourself to see how many questions you can ask in a row before, you know, you feel the need to jump in with your opinion. Or it can also be really helpful to challenge yourself to listen carefully enough that when they pause, instead of jumping in with your opinion, that you can jump in and say, okay, I just want to make sure I've really heard you. What I believe you have said here is that you think A, B, and C because of X, Y, and Z. Do I have that right? And that can be so disarming to people when they realize that you're actually putting your energy into hearing them and making sure that you've understood them. And if they say, yeah, that's right, then you can say, okay, well, would you like to hear what I think about it? And if they say no, you know, frankly, you've dodged a bullet by like not even trying to express yourself to someone who's truly that hostile. But usually that's a good segue into a true dialogue.
Your book also offers some strategies for building resilience against backlash when you're expressing a controversial opinion. Can you talk about a couple of exercises that people can do that you've included in the book?
Yeah, definitely. So sometimes it's helpful to just, you know, again, really begin to understand what type of backlash are you potentially experiencing. So, you know, if you're in the workplace or at your university, it can be helpful to just take your policy manual and upload it into ChatGPT, for example, and just say, hey, I'm thinking of expressing an opinion about, you know, saying like, why do we have a women's affinity group, but we can't have a men's affinity group? Like, how is that fair, right? And I'm concerned about, you know, backlash for expressing that. Can you tell me my institution's policies about, you know, expressing ideas? And hopefully chat will come back to you and say, oh yeah, your university policy manual section such and such, you know, tells you that, you know, the university encourages dialogue, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can make sure that you've got that information in hand with you. On the other hand, if you discover that, you know, there really is no policy supporting your ability to express yourself, then at least you really know what you're up against. And it can be helpful as well to just write down some of your key talking points, because when, you know, things get heated, people can kind of blank out, as well as it can be helpful across the board in a personal or institutional setting to do what psychologists call narrating your experience. So to just lay it out for someone before you jump in and to say, look, I want to share some ideas that I know are probably going to be a little different, that haven't been expressed so much. And to be honest, I'm a little nervous about it, but I'd really like to share in the interest of being authentic. And when you set it up that way, you hopefully somebody, the listener, will go out of their way that they want to be that good listener, right? So you're kind of priming them to be in their best listening behavior. And then also just depending on your state laws and whatnot, in some cases, it's helpful to record the conversation. Like, again, depending on the situation, if you're truly worried about, you know, retaliation or backlash over viewpoint discrimination, and if it actually would be illegal for your employer or your school to retaliate against you and you're genuinely concerned about it, depending on the situation, you may want to consider, you know, checking with a lawyer and potentially even recording it.
There is a portion of the book in which you share your own personal experience with this topic that led you to write the book in the first place. Would you mind sharing that?
Yeah, so I just myself, like I said, I didn't even think about this stuff myself too much. I was in New York City as a young woman and, you know, going through academia. I was in the media a lot, Manhattan, all these very left-leaning environments. And so I had just second nature almost learned to just keep certain things back if I wanted to be successful. And it was almost like the frog slowly getting cooked. And then the last straw was during COVID when they were masking little kids. And I couldn't handle the fact that nobody was talking about it. And I said, look, this is going to probably burn some media relationships and maybe even some of my, you know, fancy corporate speaking relationships. But as a public service announcement, I just felt I had to do it. So I wrote out all the reasons why, from a mental health and developmental perspective, I was concerned about this, put it into an article, and ran by some colleagues to say, like, am I missing something here? Like, before I go out on a limb here and share this? And they said, no, this is all correct, Chloe, but you should not share it because it could discourage people from masking their children. And I was like, well, this makes no sense, right, for them to say that. Yeah. So I shared it. And Dr. Jay Bhattacharya picked it up, and Buck Sexton picked it up. And I started having dialogues with parents all over the country. They were saying, thank you for giving me the vocabulary, the psychological vocabulary to answer back at these school board meetings and explain why, you know, no, we don't want to mask our kids. It's not just some personal preference. We have legitimate concerns about why this could be harmful to our children. And, you know, just by dialoguing with all these people, my own thought process got a lot deeper. And I noticed my own emotional regulation about the issue, you know, improved a lot. I had been, when I first started sharing about it, I was really, really edgy and really, really fiery because I'd been holding back so much. But the more I started talking about it, you know, I just started to kind of even out about it, and I could be a more effective communicator. And I started to realize I was holding back about a lot of stuff, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, wait a minute, I'm a psychologist. How could I not have known that holding back, repression, suppression, denial, all these things are not good for our mental health? Of course we should be speaking up about what we really think and believe. All of us should, not just me. And so that's why I wrote the book.
And yet you said you had a little bit of difficulty with some publishers. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because you mentioned that the publishing industry leans left, which it certainly does? Do you think that was part of it, or do you think that they weren't convinced of the importance of a book about free speech? What do you think held them back, or did they even explicitly address that?
You know, they didn't say it explicitly, but for example, my previous book was a success, and my big publisher for it, that's a big five publisher, they said to me, Chloe, we'd love to do another book with you, just not this one. And I kind of tried to press and probe. They wouldn't say why. I had a very fancy literary agent. When I first emailed them about this idea, they ignored my email. And then I followed up and I got a very terse response, like, no, this is not for us. And then, you know, I followed up again and they were like, we think you should seek other representation. So, wow. Yeah, I mean, you know, thankfully, I did find a wonderful publisher, Skyhorse. They're the same publisher as Tulsi Gabbard and RFKJ and Melania Trump. So I'm thankful in the end to have connected with Skyhorse.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting, especially for a book about free speech.
Yeah.
And especially on a topic that, as we talked about earlier, 84% of Americans consider to be a serious issue.
Yeah. And that statistic, by the way, that 84%, as you said, it may be worse now because that's a 2022 poll, believe it or not, wow, by the New York Times with Siena College. And so the New York Times in 2022 was acknowledging this. You can only imagine like what the real numbers are, right?
Yes, especially after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, you can see what a serious, and as I mentioned earlier, potentially life-threatening issue free speech has become.
Definitely. I mean, for example, in another recent study by Rutgers, more than half of respondents that were on the left indicated that it would be at least partially justified to destroy Tesla dealerships or to murder Elon Musk or to murder Donald Trump. And statistics do show that it's the same people. I call it the five D's in my book. Liberals are statistically more likely to defriend on social media, to distance or drop contact in real life, to decline to date across the aisle, or to disinvite a speaker over political differences. The liberals are statistically more likely to do all of those things. The liberal respondents to YouGov polls are also 2 to 8 times more likely to endorse violence. So again, as a psychologist, if I'm working with violent offenders, the first thing we want to do is teach them to use dialogue when they're upset instead of violence. Stuffing your feelings down and shutting down dialogue is setting the table for violence. So I think you're absolutely right to notice that people who are not in favor of free speech can become violent, which can make it a fearsome environment for people that do want to speak out.
Dr. Chloe, I read a lot of books, but I confess that I do not gravitate often toward this genre of psychology or self-help. But I have to say, as with your previous book, Nervous Energy, I found this one really useful, really interesting, really well-researched, and thought-provoking because it raised some points that I myself didn't consider. So listeners, for anyone trying to navigate a culture that's currently at literally violent odds over the issue of free speech, I highly recommend this book, Can I Say That? I think if people on both sides of the issue read this and took it to heart, it would be a great start toward healing this Grand Canyon-sized political divide in our nation. Dr. Chloe, in addition to reading this book and working on the techniques that you lay out, how can people keep up with what you were doing in your work?
Yeah, well, thank you, Mark. I would love to invite them to come to freespeechtoday.com. If you come to freespeechtoday.com, you can see, of course, about the books, as well as all of my social media handles. I do especially love to be active on Twitter, but I'm active everywhere on social media. And I'm hosting free online discussion groups for people that want to read the book and talk with other like-minded people and talk about the techniques and or just talk about the concepts of free speech and just be with other people that care about the mental health benefits of free speech. So they can come to freespeechtoday.com and do that.
Oh, good to know. That's awesome. Dr. Chloe Carmichael, thanks for coming back to The Right Take. I love having you on.
Thanks again, Mark.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.